Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Hello, and thank you for joining us for the January 28, 2022, Friday edition of the Denver Post. My name is Tammy. Today, I'll be reading the following main articles. Vail Resorts Faces Growing Backlash by John Mayer of the Denver Post. COVID-19 in Colorado Report Cases to Go Down by Meg Wingerter of the Denver Post. Broncos Hire Hackett as Coach by Ryan O'Halloran of the Denver Post. Study Gas Stoves Worse for Climate Than Thought by Seth Borenstein of the Associated Press, and I'll be following up with miscellaneous articles. Our lead story, Company Blames Pandemic for Woes. Vail Resorts Faces Growing Backlash. Skiers, Boarders Across U.S. Complain of Lack of Terrain, Staffing, by John Mayer of the Denver Post. Dateline, Crested Butte. Several Vail Resorts properties across the country are facing backlash from skiers and snowboarders, many of them longtime customers. The problem has not been a lack of snow. While it came late this season, two huge December storms dumped 90 inches on Crested Butte alone. Streets here are lined with massive snowbanks, and nearly all of the mountain ski terrain has been open. But the lifts to reach that terrain? Vail Resorts has struggled to keep those operating amid a staffing problem the company blames on the Omicron variant, even as its labor practices at resorts around the country have come under fire. After several major acquisitions in recent years, including Crested Butte in 2018, Broomfield-based Vail Resorts is now the largest ski area operator in the United States, with more than 30 properties in Colorado, California, Pennsylvania, New York, Vermont, and beyond. While ski areas across the country, and mountain towns in particular, have struggled with staffing this year amid Omicron, high housing costs, and a national labor shortage, Vail Resorts has faced a cacophony of complaints on social media and in national news stories from outlets such as the Wall Street Journal, alleging long lift lines, unplowed parking lots, limited terrain, and frustrated, overworked employees. The first two things they need to do is pay their people and house their people, said Dennis Hall, 72, who has had Crested Butte season passes for 54 years. I gave them 3 years, and they didn't make my skiing better. They made my skiing worse. I've been here through four different owners of the ski area, and this is the first one that has actively destroyed the ski culture that has been here through all those owners for all those years. They've made the place a lot worse. An anti-Vail Resorts online petition started by a local resident has garnered more than 400 supporters. That petition was inspired by another that was created by former Crested Butte resident Jeremy Rubing, which blasted Vail Resorts for the way it is managing the Stevens Pass ski area in Washington State. Rubing expected perhaps a couple of hundred people would respond, but his petition has been supported by nearly 44,000 people since it was posted December 28th, sparking anti-Vail Resorts complaints from coast to coast. Many of those comments have come from Colorado, where Vail Resorts owns Vail, Beaver Creek, Breckenridge, Keystone, and Crested Butte. The most common complaints, limited terrain offerings over the Christmas holidays, and other problems caused by staffing shortages. Will Allisberg, who had driven to Crested Butte from New York City with his girlfriend, was overjoyed Tuesday when the resort opened its high lift to the top of the mountain for the first time this season. That T-bar lift serves some of the steepest terrain on the mountain, but opening lifts and keeping them open has been a challenge for mountain managers there because of staffing shortages. When it finally opened Tuesday, it was the seventh day of Aliceberg's ski vacation. There are all sorts of fun runs up there, Aliceberg said. Given that it hadn't opened until now, a lot of the terrain was really untouched, and that was some of the best powder on the mountain. But on Wednesday, that lift was closed again. The terrain it accesses remained open, but skiers had to hike to get there. At Vail Mountain, skiers and snowboarders found only about 60% of the terrain open over the Christmas holidays. That mountain's chief operating officer, Beth Howard, blamed early season weather and staff shortages caused by COVID-19. In Washington State, Attorney General Bob Ferguson weighed in on the Vail Resort's complaints last week, tweeting that his office had received more than 80 comments about Stevens Pass over the past 2 months. This is a significant number of complaints in a short period of time, Ferguson tweeted. If you have been impacted or have information, I'm asking that you file a complaint with my office. Only about 40% of Stevens Pass was open over the holidays, Rubing said. Rubing has lived in Seattle for 2 years, but he was born and raised in Colorado, and he spent most of his adult life in Crested Butte. Living in Crested Butte, I watched Vail Resorts come in, Rubing said. Initially, there was some optimism. It was like, okay, this is an established company that knows how to do skiing. They know how to do infrastructure. Maybe they can start paying people better. Maybe things will run more efficiently. Instead, what happened was the exact opposite. Vail Resorts' 5 Colorado areas are reporting that 90% or more of their terrain is open. Chief Executive Kirsten Lynch, who is in her first winter at the helm of the company, announced 2 weeks ago that employees will receive a bonus of $2 per hour for all hours worked from January 1st until the end of the ski season. They must stick it out to the end to receive their bonuses, which will be paid in May. The company also says it increased the minimum wage it pays at Colorado resorts this season from $12.25 to $15 per hour. Meanwhile, news stories about Vail's labor practices are adding increased scrutiny. This season, ski patrol at Vail Run Slopes in Park City, Utah, nearly went on strike, citing low pay as the dominant factor, according to reporting in the Salt Lake Tribune, before reaching a tentative agreement in mid-January. In California, Vail has extended a $13.1 million offer to settle 5 wage and labor lawsuits, alleging that the company violated state and federal labor laws by failing to pay reimbursements for equipment and not compensating workers for time spent training in meetings or gearing up before shifts on the mountain. The California lawsuit is similar to a class action lawsuit filed in Colorado District Court back in December 2020 and could spell trouble for Vail Resorts in the form of payouts for about 100,000 employees nationwide, according to reporting from Vail Daily. But Vail's CEO says the pandemic, not its labor practices, is to blame. We want nothing more than to provide each of our guests with an incredible experience at our resorts, Lynch said in a statement to the Denver Post. The reality is we are still operating during a pandemic, facing a global staffing shortage and the very real impacts of Omicron on our workforce, with daily COVID-19 cases in Colorado going up 9-fold in the 3-week period over the Christmas and New Year holidays. We take very seriously the feedback from any disappointed guest and want them to know that we are always listening, that we are very aware of and sincerely apologize for the challenges this season, and that we are working to constantly improve. However, it is also important to recognize that we have provided millions of positive experiences already this season, something we know from our own guest feedback and research. Vail has had other challenges to manage in recent days as well. In New Hampshire, a chair detached from its lift cable and fell to the ground at Wildcat Mountain, resulting in serious rib injuries for a man who was riding the lift. In Vermont, that state's Department of Financial Regulation filed a cease and desist order, alleging that Vail Resorts is reneging on an agreement with about 30 immigrant investors that could lead to their deportation. Spokesman Quinn Kelsey said the company is confident our practices are fully compliant. Last week, the Denver Post invited online comments from skiers and snowboarders asking how they rate their experiences with Vail Resorts. More than 250 people responded, most of them with complaints. Many complaints came from outside Colorado, and most had the same complaints that Rubing and his petition respondents have raised: limited terrain openings, staff shortages that impact resort operations, and a widespread perception that Vail Resorts needs to pay its workers more. People are angry and employees are angry, wrote John Tomlinson of Parker, who typically skis at Breckenridge, Vail, and Beaver Creek. I have seen more Vail Resorts employee meltdowns this year than any other year. Nothing is about the customer. People make sacrifices to live in expensive areas like San Francisco and New York because they can find value and fulfillment in their jobs and lifestyle. Vail Resorts is struggling to offer this to their employees, and this breach in culture and values has a ripple effect that impacts the customer experience. Eric Moxham of Park City, Utah, cited gross mismanagement at Park City Mountain Resort with complete disregard for the experience of PCMR guests. Great companies are a byproduct of happy customers and happy employees, Moxham wrote. Loyalty is hard-earned but quick to lose when there is not a fair value exchange for both parties. Apparently, the fine folks in Broomfield don't understand this. They will when customers evaluate their options next year and elect to spend their dollars elsewhere. But Joe Reed of Parker said he has had mostly positive experiences this year while snowboarding at Breckenridge, Beaver Creek, and Whistler in British Columbia. I think many of the Vail Resorts issues are limited to a small number of resorts, as I continue to see value in my epic pass, Reed said. I even read a story about Whistler after our New Year's Eve trip, how they canceled different ski school programs and the frustration it caused for some people on the mountain. I just did not see it, and largely haven't seen it, in 8 days riding Vail Resorts mountains so far this season. Pam Elliott of Eagle, who skis Vail and Beaver Creek, said she has had amazing experiences on those mountains this year. I ski here 50 times a year, Elliott said. People need to quit whining and enjoy the view. Meanwhile, out in the Pacific Northwest, Rubink hopes his petition will result in improved conditions at Stevens Pass and the dozens of resorts across North America that Vail Resorts owns. There are other issues in the world that are more important than this, Rubing said. I'd love to be able to activate this many people on protecting our public lands or social justice or climate change. But this resonates a lot because it's a story about corporate greed. If you have these corporate managers that are getting richer and richer, stock prices are exploding, but the wages for your workers aren't going up and you're not delivering the product that you're selling your customers, you have a real problem. People are going to say, enough. Turning to COVID-19 in Colorado, report cases to go down. Model estimates 80% of residents will be immune by mid-February, by Meg Wingerter. About one in 19 Coloradans currently is contagious with COVID-19, but the state's modeling team expects infections to decrease rapidly through February as it becomes harder for the virus to find hosts. The state's latest model, developed by the Colorado School of Public Health, estimated about 80% of residents will be immune to the Omicron variant by mid-February. Once that many people are protected by vaccination or recent infection, a contagious person is less likely to come in contact with someone who is still susceptible and can pass the virus on. That aligns with the current COVID-19 trends, state epidemiologist Dr. Rachel Herlihy said during a news briefing Thursday. Hospitalizations, new cases, and the percentage of tests coming back positive all are falling, although they remain at high levels, she said. I'm feeling optimistic about the trend of the data, Herlihy said. As of Thursday afternoon, the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment reported 1,444 people were hospitalized with COVID-19 statewide. The current wave peaked at 1,676 hospitalizations in mid-January. The number of available hospital beds is increasing, although a backlog of deferred surgeries and continuing workforce challenges as workers get sick means the progress is slow, said Scott Bookman, the state's COVID-19 incident commander. As discharges of COVID patients increase, there are other patients coming in, he said. The modeling team estimated that by late February, about 1 in 100 people will be contagious. That's a significant improvement, but it would mean the virus would still be more widespread in Colorado than it was during summer 2021. By late February, many people will still get infected. The modeling report notes that all evidence indicates infection prevalence in January 2022 is at unprecedented levels in Colorado. About 42% of Colorado residents have been infected with Omicron, and the team projected that could increase to 65% by mid-February. While any individual's odds of getting seriously sick from Omicron are lower than with previous variants, the sheer number of people expected to get the virus means some will be hospitalized and die in the coming weeks. Hospitalizations are expected to continue decreasing, although it isn't clear how fast they might fall. New York City, which was hit by Omicron about a week before Colorado was, experienced a sharp decline, while other hotspots, such as South Africa and the United Kingdom, are taking longer to come down from their hospitalization peaks. The team's report forecast a lull in infections, possibly extending into the summer, but said how long the reprieve lasts will depend on how quickly new variants of the virus emerge. Colorado confirmed one case of the new BA2 variant in December, Herlihy said, but it hasn't shown up in wastewater testing. BA2 is descended from the original Omicron, known as BA1 in scientific nomenclature, and may be somewhat more contagious. It appears to have replaced BA1 in Denmark, but other states have found only isolated cases so far, she said. We don't believe BA2 is widely circulating in Colorado, she said. A period of lower infections could be a window of opportunity to focus on reaching the unvaccinated and those who have not received a booster shot, to build up the state's testing infrastructure, and to distribute higher quality masks, the report said. Herlihy said the model's finding that cases and hospitalizations will continue to decrease is encouraging. At least in the short term, however, it's a good idea to keep taking precautions, like wearing a mask in public and avoiding large gatherings, she said. The number of infections that are occurring is still high, she said. When we get to the peak, we're only halfway there. In sports news, Green Bay offensive coordinator Broncos hire Hackett as coach by Ryan O'Halloran of the Denver Post. A Broncos franchise in acute need of an adrenaline jolt from the head coach's office and an offensive revival hopes it received both Thursday as it announced the hiring of Nathaniel Hackett. A veteran NFL coordinator widely respected for his football acumen and boundless energy, the 42-year-old Hackett agreed to terms on a 4-year contract, according to a league source. He emerged from general manager George Payton's list of 10 candidates and was the only one to receive a second interview. On Saturday, Hackett completed his third season as the Green Bay Packers offensive coordinator. Contract talks with Hackett's camp kicked into gear late Wednesday after the Broncos learned he had scheduled a second meeting with the Jacksonville Jaguars. A league source confirmed the Broncos and Hackett were closing in on an agreement around 5 a.m. Thursday, which would have been day 20 of the search. Nathaniel Hackett is a dynamic leader and coach whose intelligence, innovation, and charisma impressed us from the very start of this process, Peyton said in a statement. In addition to having a brilliant offensive mind, Nathaniel is an outstanding teacher and communicator with a strong vision for all three phases of our team. Hackett will be the Broncos' fifth head coach since 2015 and will be tasked with ending the team's streak of six consecutive years out of the playoffs, the longest since 1976, and five straight losing seasons, the longest since 1972. He replaces Vic Fangio, who was fired January 9th after posting a 19-30 record. Hackett initially met with the Broncos on January 14th in Wisconsin. Peyton and company completed their 10th candidate interview last Friday in Kansas City and returned to the Denver area for 2 days of deliberations. When the Packers were upset by San Francisco in the divisional round Saturday, Hackett became available for a follow-up interview. The Broncos flew Hackett via private plane into the Centennial Airport across the street from the team's headquarters on Monday morning. He spent several hours at the facility and met extensively with Peyton as well as department heads on the football and non-football sides. The impression of Hackett was overwhelmingly positive, according to a source, who added team employees and executives were buzzing about Hackett's heavy-on-enthusiasm and short-on-gruffness demeanor. But as the week progressed, it appears the Broncos still were interested in visiting with Dallas Cowboys defensive coordinator Dan Quinn and Los Angeles Rams offensive coordinator Kevin O'Connell, the latter of whom could not be contacted until next Monday. Peyton, though, moved forward after the Jaguars renewed interest in Hackett, and the Broncos were the first of the 9 head coaching openings to be filled, soon after Quinn announced that he was staying in Dallas. Did the Broncos go 180 degrees away from Fangio? In theory, yes. Fangio is 63 and Hackett is 42. Fangio's expertise is defense and Hackett's is offense. And Fangio is old school. Nothing wrong with that. Hackett is new school. One of his play calls in Jacksonville included the word segue. The only similarity is both were hired by the Broncos as first-time head coaches. Always in a good mood, a league executive said in a text. Great dude, an NFL assistant said. He's one of the smartest coaches and people that I know and the most organized. I think that's what his players are going to benefit the most from, are his organizational skills, said New York Jets tight end coach Ron Middleton, who worked with Hackett in Tampa Bay and Jacksonville. All of Hackett's smarts and organizational skills will be required to jumpstart a Broncos team that has finished last in the AFC West the past 2 years and has averaged 10 losses per season since 2017. Because Hackett was Green Bay's offensive coordinator the past 3 years, the natural connection is this will lead to Packers quarterback Aaron Rodgers joining the Broncos. The reality? The Broncos were expected to go franchise quarterback hunting this offseason, regardless of which coach they hired. And although it may be convenient to hire somebody close to and respected by Rodgers, it wasn't the top reason he was hired. The top reason is Peyton feels confident Hackett, who is expected to call the offensive plays, can revive an offense that has failed to finish among the top 15 teams in points scored since 2014 and find stability and productivity at quarterback regardless of who is acquired. From developing young players to working with all-time greats as a key part of winning teams, Nathaniel has had tremendous success in this league, Peyton said. He's a student of the game and knows how to put players in position to win. A Rodgers-Hackett tandem wouldn't make the Broncos the instant division or Super Bowl favorite, but it would make the team relevant for the first time since Peyton Manning retired after the 2015 championship season. The Broncos have the cap space, more than $40 million, and draft picks, 5 in rounds 1 through 3, to offer the Packers for the 38-year-old Rodgers, who is expected to win his second consecutive NFL MVP award next month. "He's a great coach," Rodgers said during a recent appearance on the Pat McAfee Show. "I love spending time with him. He's a fantastic teacher." Hackett, whose father, Paul, was a longtime coach in the NFL and college, earned his teaching chops at myriad stops since entering the profession at Cal Davis in 2003 while finishing his degree. He would attend a 10-hour lab class and then go to football practice. He initially wanted to become a doctor, but said in 2016, "It didn't hit me until I was done playing. I really enjoyed football." Hackett moved on to Stanford, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, Buffalo Bills, Syracuse, the Bills again, Jacksonville, and Green Bay. In the NFL, he called the plays in Buffalo in 2013 to 2014 and Jacksonville from mid-2016 to mid-2018. In 2017, Hackett first appeared on the head coaching radar when the Jaguars improved from 3-13 to 10-6, led the league in rushing, and reached the AFC title game, losing to New England. But things fell apart the following year, and Hackett joined the staff in Green Bay. This has been the ultimate goal for him, but the way he's carried himself and just continued to improve and learn has been outstanding, Middleton said. He's very deserving and hardworking and ready for this job. Environment Study: Gas Stoves Worse for Climate Than Thought, by Seth Borenstein. Gas stoves are contributing more to global warming than previously thought because of constant tiny methane leaks while they're off, a new study found. The same study that tested emissions around stoves in homes raised new concerns about indoor air quality and health because of levels of nitrogen oxides measured. Even when they are not running, U.S. gas stoves are putting 2.6 million tons of methane in carbon dioxide equivalent units into the air each year, a team of California researchers found in a study published in Thursday's journal Environmental Science and Technology. That's equivalent to the annual amount of greenhouse gases from 500,000 cars, or what the United States puts into the air every 3.5 hours. "They're constantly bleeding a little bit of methane into the atmosphere all the time," said the study's co-author Rob Jackson, a Stanford University climate scientist. "That methane is on top of the 6.8 million tons of carbon dioxide that gas stoves emit into the air when they're in use, and the gas is burned," the study said. "Methane is a greenhouse gas that is dozens of times more potent than carbon dioxide, but it doesn't stay in the atmosphere nearly as long, and it isn't as plentiful in the air." The researchers examined 53 home kitchens in California, many in bed and breakfast that they rented. They sealed most of the rooms in plastic tarps and then measured emissions when the stoves were working and when they were not. And what was surprising was that 3/4 of the methane released happened while the stoves were off, Jackson said. "Those are emissions releases that the government does not account for," he said. "That's a big deal because we're trying to really reduce our carbon footprint, and we claim that gas is cleaner than coal, which it is," said study lead author Eric Lebel, a scientist at PSE Healthy Energy, an Oakland nonprofit. But he said much of the benefit disappears when leaks are taken into account. Many communities have bans on gas stove use in future new construction that will take effect in future years, including New York City and the Bay Area cities of San Francisco, Oakland, San Jose, and Berkeley, Jackson said. People can already choose electric appliances if they want, said Frank Misano, a Washington policy and public relations expert who represents gas and appliance interest. People just like gas appliances because they perform better, especially in colder climates. Natural gas appliances are generally more energy and cost-effective than their electric counterparts, Misano said. Jackson estimated that when all natural gas use and extraction is taken into account, about 100 million tons of gas leaks into the atmosphere. And the couple million tons from gas stoves is meaningful. That's a substantial part, and it's a part that we haven't included accurately in the past. The leakage finding is a very important takeaway and fits with other work that found there are often big leaks that account for much of the emissions, said Zachary Marin, a research engineer with the Illinois Applied Research Institute's Indoor Climate Research and Training Group. Marin, who wasn't part of the study, said the emission of uncombusted methane is clearly bad. From an emission standpoint, cooking directly with gas is better than using a fossil fuel-powered electric stove, but worse than using a solar-powered electric stove. The methane leak isn't dangerous to human health or as a possible explosive, Jackson said. But when conducting the test, researchers found high levels of nitrogen oxides, greater than 100 parts per billion. Jackson said the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency doesn't have indoor air quality standards for that gas, but the measurements they took exceeded its outdoor air quality standards. Methane doesn't include nitrogen, but the nitrogen oxides are byproducts of the combustion in natural gas ovens, he said. Misano said people should always use good hood ranges and make sure they have proper ventilation. Jackson, who has a gas stove that he plans to replace, said he never used ventilation before this study, but that he now does so every time. Moving to page 2, man sentenced to 24 years in child sex assault. A man was sentenced to 24 years to life in prison Wednesday for a child sex assault in Arvada. Ron Gregory Wyman, 63, has been convicted of multiple prior crimes, including second-degree murder in 1993, according to a Jefferson County District Attorney's news release. A Denver jury found Wyman guilty of murder, and he was sentenced to 28 years in prison. He completed his sentence and was released in November 2018. But on January 12, 2020, Arvada officers responded to a thrift store on a report of a man groping a child, the release said. Wyman tried to leave the scene, but the victim's mother stood in front of his car in a parking lot to keep him there until police arrived. In May 2021, Wyman was found guilty by a Jefferson County jury of sexually assaulting the 11-year-old victim. Prior to the 1993 murder conviction in Denver, Wyman had been arrested in California. Wyman has an extensive record of sexual offenses in California dating back to 1987, when he received 3 years of probation for indecent exposure in front of children, according to the release. And that was written by Kieran Nicholson of the Denver Post. And this story from the Associated Press, man identified through DNA, charged in 1978 killing. Dateline San Francisco. A man arrested in Colorado on suspicion of killing a teenage girl in San Francisco more than four decades ago has been charged with murder in her death, prosecutors said. Mark Stanley Personette, 76, was arrested in suburban Denver in December after a joint operation by San Francisco police, the FBI, and the Jefferson County Sheriff's Office. He was booked for investigation of homicide in connection with the 1978 death of 15-year-old Marissa Harvey. Personette was arraigned in a San Francisco court Thursday. The case sat cold for 43 years until a DNA hit in a genealogy database linked DNA taken from the crime scene to Personette, San Francisco District Attorney Chesa Boudin said in a statement. Harvey of New York was visiting her sister in San Francisco when she didn't return from a day trip to Golden Gate Park. Her body was found a day later in nearby Sutro Heights Park. Legislature. Bill would increase age to buy assault-style weapons, by Alex Burness of the Denver Post. A Colorado lawmaker whose son was murdered in the Aurora Theater shooting of 2012 is proposing a new state law that would raise the minimum age to purchase assault-style weapons from 18 to 21. Centennial Representative Tom Sullivan, father of Alex Sullivan, said he's still working out the specifics of his bill, but that he plans to introduce it this legislative session. Representative Meg Frohlich, a Greenwood Village Democrat, and Senator Sonia Jaquez Lewis, a Boulder County Democrat, have signed on as sponsors. Their legislation will not affect weapons designed for sportsmen, they say. Rather, they want to impose stricter limits on guns that are commonly used in mass death incidents. They may model their definition of assault weapon after the definition adopted by Boulder, which has its own ban on pistols and semi-automatic rifles with pistol grips, folding or telescoping stocks, or any protruding grip allowing a weapon to be stabilized with the non-trigger hand. I have talked with the bill drafters about, well, why don't we just define it as this is what you can buy, a shotgun, a single bolt action, Sullivan said, and anything else you can't. It's like we said when you turn 18, you can buy 3.2% alcohol by volume beer. We didn't have to define what a top shelf tequila was. The advocacy organization Every Town for Gun Safety reports that people ages 18 to 20 commit 18% of gun homicides, although they only make up 4% of the population. Colorado law already prohibits the purchase of handguns by people under 21, so Sullivan's proposal would build on that. Similar policies have been adopted in a handful of other states, including Florida, in the wake of the 2018 mass shooting at a high school in Parkland. It's Sullivan's belief that gun violence legislation should be discussed every year at the Capitol and not just after mass shootings. Democrats control the legislature, and they've been with him on that, passing 7 new gun laws since they seized a legislative trifecta, House, Senate, Governor's Office, in 2018. 6 of those were signed into law last session after the mass shooting at a King Soopers in Boulder. Each of those laws was carefully choreographed. State House leaders and Governor Jared Polis like to be sure gun legislation actually will pass before extending political capital. They also have said they want to pass laws in this area only when they meaningfully reduce gun violence. Sullivan may yet win over his colleagues on this proposal, but unlike those 7 gun laws in 2018, this one is less of a party priority. Of his state house colleagues, Sullivan said, they don't have any problem going after big tobacco every year, but they shy away from doing things to prevent gun violence. The governor didn't even mention the word guns in the state of the state. Neither the speaker, Alec Garnett, nor the minority leader, Hugh McKean, talked about gun violence prevention at all in their opening statements on the first day of this year's session. So it's incumbent upon me to continue to talk about it because it impacts our communities each and every day. While this bill has not been made a caucus headliner or been vetted thoroughly by the Senate and Governor's Office, each legislator in Colorado is allowed to bring 5 bills every year without needing permission. Sullivan said this will be one of his 5. Its path to passage remains uncertain. Speaker Garnett, who is close to Sullivan and has co-sponsored gun-related legislation with him in the past, said he's proud of the tremendous progress that Colorado has made in recent years in this area, but that he's less bullish on this particular proposal. Our focus has been on legislation that we know will be effective and that will save lives, Garnett said in a statement. We haven't seen evidence that raising the age to purchase an assault weapon would have that level of effectiveness. But I remain committed to working hand in hand with Representative Sullivan to continue the tremendous work he's done to save lives. We need to be focused on data-driven solutions that will have the most impact, or we may set back the progress we've made. Garnett's counterpart in the Senate, President Leroy Garcia, said in his own statement that he has not had any conversations with my colleagues about the bill, an indication of how different the process on this one has been in comparison to the processes that yielded the other seven laws since 2018. Garcia is keenly aware, as Democrats are generally, of how sensitive lawmaking is in this area. In 2013, two state senators, one from Garcia's hometown of Pueblo and another from Colorado Springs, were recalled for backing a post-Aurora shooting high-capacity magazine ban and universal background check law. I will be taking a long, hard look at this bill once it reaches the Senate, Garcia said. It is also telling that the leading gun violence prevention organizations, such as Every Town and the Giffords Law Center, aren't publicly out in force behind this proposal. They may yet back it, but groups such as that have been involved closely in the choreographed rollouts of other recent Colorado Democrat-led gun laws. Frolich, Sullivan's co-lead in the House, said the bill is worthwhile despite its likely shortcomings, namely that the bill doesn't prevent illegal gun sales and may do little to affect the number of people ages 18 through 20 in possession of assault-style weapons. Under existing law, she said, the point is it's going to be harder for a 19-year-old to get a beer. Less 19-year-olds are going to drink and drive. We're never dealing in absolutes, so we're chipping away at the problem of gun violence. It's broad. We need other supports. But I don't have a problem with chipping away. I don't need to have an absolute to do what's right. This won't be the only new gun law Democrats consider passing this year. They're primed to support the Vote Without Fear Act, HB 22-1086, a bill Sullivan is sponsoring to ban open carry of firearms at or near polling sites. They may also pass a bill seeking to eliminate so-called ghost guns, that is, unserialized and thus untraceable guns, but they're hoping federal action on that front renders a state bill needless. And there are quite a few obituaries in today's Denver Post, so I will read the basics from those. Ida Garneck, 98, a Holocaust survivor, passed away January 25, 2022, wife of the late Morris Garneck, mother of Tilly Rollin, Sam Garneck, and Joe Garneck. Service Friday, 1 p.m., HEA. All are welcome. Live stream on HEA's YouTube channel. Interment Mount Nebo Memorial Park. Live stream on Feldman Mortuary's YouTube channel. Contributions to JFS, Denver Hospice, or HEA. Rachel Woodhouse Kester, born November 26, 1916, and died December 23, 2021. Rachel W. Kester died at home at the age of 105, surrounded by her loving family. She was born in Bloomington, Wisconsin. In 1940, she married Randall Blair Kester, and the two of them settled in Portland, Oregon, where Randall practiced law and where they lived until his death in 2012. Rachel then moved to Boulder, Colorado, to be near her three daughters. She was a fiber artist and engaged in other arts. Rachel was predeceased by her parents, her sister Ella Jane Swan, and brother Milton K. Woodhouse and husband of 71 years, Randall Kester. She is survived by her daughters, Laura Kester and Lynn Kester Mayer of Boulder, Dr. Sylvia O'Bowler of Denver, and granddaughter Virginia Kester Mayer of Boulder. In lieu of services, please remember Rachel by enjoying time in the outdoors or taking up a new art project. Contributions to a food bank would be appreciated. Irene Kane Mabel, born January 12, 1926, and passed away December 19, 2021, after suffering a stroke on November 24, 2021, preceded in death by her husband of 71 years. Donald, and her daughters Jennifer Hall and Sharon Messenger. Surviving Irene are children Gail Beach, Elsa Vreeland, Doug Mabel, Lori Wagner, along with 18 grandchildren and 10 great-grandchildren. She spent 20 years as a guidance counselor at North Glen High School. A celebration of life will be planned for June when travel allows everyone to be together. If interested, Irene's favorite nonprofits were Big Brothers, Big Sisters Mountain Region, and the Morgan Adams Foundation. Walden Wally Swank, born June 2, 1933, and died December 25, 2021. Walden was an artist. He was born in Hays, Kansas. Wally's biggest accomplishment was raising five children with his beautiful wife, Ava, whom he met on tennis courts at City Park in 1963. He is survived by Ava Swank, their children Chris Swank, Russ Swank, Jill Griffiths, Michael Swank, and Robert Swank. He is also survived by his grandchildren Ardell, Perry, Aiden, Hannah, Lola, Roland, and Matthew. A funeral mass will be celebrated at 10:30 a.m., rosary at 10 a.m., on Tuesday, February 1st, 2022, at Blessed Sacrament Catholic Church. The family kindly requests only vaccinated guests attend. A private burial will be held at Fort Logan National Cemetery. Lawrence Michael Underwood, born October 26, 1952, and died January 21, 2022. Mike passed away suddenly at age 69. He was born in Denver, Colorado, to Robert and Janice Underwood. He worked in finance. Mike is survived by the love of his life, Deanie, his children, Jennifer Johnson, Brad Underwood, and his five grandchildren, Maddie, Cooper, Lanning, Jovi, and Walker, along with his former spouse and dear friend, Valerie Scott. In lieu of flowers, the family requests that donations be made in Mike's honor to the Boys and Girls Club of Metro Denver or the Colorectal Cancer Alliance. A celebration of life will be hosted on January 28th at 12 p.m. at the Denver Country Club. Mary Louise Cass Tice died peacefully January 16, 2022, surrounded by her three loving children. She was born April 13, 1935, to Edward and Evelyn Cass and was raised with her younger brother William in Denver. She married the love of her life, Robert W. Tice, on April 13, 1958. Mary is survived by her children, Neil Tice, Susan Witt, and Cynthia Weirs, their spouses, six grandchildren, and six great-grandchildren. A celebration of life will be held in Denver at a later date. Bonnie L. Varner of Littleton passed away. Viewing is Saturday, January 29th at 10 a.m. with a celebration of life at 11 a.m. at the chapel at Ellis Family. Life sketch and tribute wall available at ellisfamilyservices.com. Rod Brettauer, born January 28, 1952, and passed away March 24, 2021. Rod would have turned 70 on January 28, 2022. He was born in Greeley, Colorado. Rod graduated from Brighton High School and Adams State University. He is survived by his loving mother, Betty Brettauer Nail, and sister Roxanne Brettauer O'Reilly. He's greatly missed by his family and friends. And returning to the news, Colorado Public Utilities Commission. Consumer advocates criticize Xcel. Group plans to file a protest over proposed $188.6 million natural gas rate increase by Judith Kohler of the Denver Post. The agency that represents the public before the Colorado Public Utilities Commission says Xcel Energy's proposed natural gas rate increase of $188.6 million over 3 years is unjustified and plans to file a protest. Xcel Energy, which has 1.4 million natural gas customers in Colorado, filed the rate request Monday with the PUC. If approved, bills would rise November 1st. The rate request comes as state regulators are considering Xcel Energy's proposed $182 million increase in electric rates. The PUC also will decide requests by Xcel Energy and other companies to recover their cost from a February 2021 storm that plunged temperatures below zero from Texas to the Midwest and sent natural gas prices soaring. The Office of the Utility Consumer Advocate said not all Xcel Energy customers buy both electricity and natural gas from the company, but there is a significant overlap. The office signed on to a partial settlement in the $182 million electric rate case, but it opposes Xcel Energy's proposed natural gas increase. Cindy Schoenhout, the agency's director, said the PUC has referred to the company's pancaking of proposed rate increases. "This is a frequent thing. This is pancakes on pancakes," Schoenhout said. "What's kind of shocking is that there was a rate increase on the gas side by Xcel in 2020. The $94 million or 19% increase took effect in April 2021. Xcel Energy President Alice Jackson said in a letter to the PUC that the utility was required to submit the new filing to comply with agreements in previous natural gas rate cases. However, Schoenhout said the filing could have been a formality and didn't have to include a substantial jump in rates. Under Xcel Energy's proposal, the average residential customer's monthly bill would rise by $4.16 starting in November, $1.83 in November 2023, and $2.15 in November 2024. The average monthly increases for small businesses would be $19.09 in November, $7.30 in 2023, and $8.37 in 2024. The current average residential monthly bill is $62.42, and the average small commercial monthly bill is $251.19. The proposed rate increases do not cover increases Xcel Energy pays for natural gas, which are passed through to customers. The company would not seek additional rate increases that would take effect before November 2025, Xcel Energy spokesman Michelle Aguayo said. In her letter to the PUC, Jackson said Xcel Energy wants to ensure that its base rates accurately reflect the cost of providing service. She said the revenue will help cover the expense of meeting growing energy needs across the state, improving gas pipelines, and further reducing greenhouse gas emissions from its operations while affordably meeting customers' needs. "If you're committed to affordability, what's with all these rate increases?" Schoenhout asked. AARP Colorado spoke against higher electric rates during a PUC hearing last week. The organization is also concerned about the proposed natural gas increases because of the impact on residential customers, especially low-income customers and ones on fixed incomes, said Bill Levis, a consultant formerly with the Colorado Office of Consumer Counsel. "I just received my monthly energy bill from Xcel, and my gas bill was 44% higher than last January, even though I used the same number of therms, units of gas, this month and last January," Levis said in an email. Of particular concern to Schoenhout is Xcel Energy's request to raise rates over 3 years. Instead of being based on a previous year's costs, which can be verified, the utility's proposed increases would be based on forecast, she said. "If you're just looking at forecasts, it takes a form of guessing, especially as you go out 2 or 3 years. That's a big problem," Schoenhout said. Xcel Energy has said its gas and electric rates are lower than the national average. Schoenhout agreed that they are, but she said that's not the issue. "They always posit it that way, as if to say they can just keep raising them as long as they're under the national average. That just doesn't wash," Schoenhout said. When proposing rates, a regulated utility should look at what increases its cost to justify while making a reasonable profit, she added. That's the test for a regulated monopoly. It's not a competitive business. In other news, university mistakenly told 58 students they won full rides. A full ride including tuition, room, and board, plus a $5,000 award to study abroad and admission to the school's honors program. That's what 58 high school seniors were told they would receive from Central Michigan University when they were notified last weekend that they had been awarded the school's prestigious Centralis Scholar Award. But on Sunday, they all got horrible news. They had been sent that message by mistake. In fact, they had not been awarded the scholarship. 3 days later, however, the university said it planned to pay 4 years of full tuition for the students who had been mistakenly told that they had been awarded full rides. They will not, however, receive other perks of the scholarship, the school said. We deeply regret the disappointment and frustration caused by the test message error in the student portal, the university said. The university said the messages about the award were sent out inadvertently by school staff members when new messaging technology was being tested. On Sunday, the university's executive director of admissions contacted the families of students who had received the messages by mistake to apologize for the miscommunication. Central Michigan said, to make it right, the 58 students who had received the congratulatory message by mistake would now receive offers to increase their award amount to the equivalent of a full tuition scholarship. Thank you for joining us for the Friday edition of the Denver Post. My name is Tammy.